And so this morning we continue on our series of the Sermon on the Mount, that series of lessons that is absolutely considered to be Jesus' most famous and most powerful. And we join Jesus today on that summit overlooking the Sea of Galilee. Personally, having been there, I think Sermon on the Summit would be a better title than Sermon on the Mountain, because it is more of a summit than a mountain. We would consider it a large hill here in Missouri, but at any rate, it's called the Sermon on the Mount. And according to Matthew, this takes place with only Jesus' disciples. And so today we're really moving into sort of the midpoint of the Sermon on the Mount, really beyond the midpoint, chapter 6 in the Gospel of Matthew. And so we have really reviewed some of that earlier, if you were with us in September, when we talked about the Lord's Prayer, because this is the chapter that contains the Lord's Prayer. In case you missed that lesson, where Julie Godey helped us with the Aramaic, it was really very powerful experience. In case you missed that, you can get it on our website, September 9th. The title was Pray Then Like This. So today we're going to go forward now with what Jesus says after the Lord's Prayer. But first we're going to do a little backing up to see what he says directly before. We looked at this, but I just want to review it a little bit. He says, "So when you give to the needy, do not announce it with trumpets." Now, that was Jesus' humor and hyperbole, because obviously nobody would be giving with trumpets, but the disciples would have thought that was funny. We miss a lot of Jesus' humor today. "So do not announce it with trumpets, as the hypocrites do in the synagogues and on the streets, to be honored by others. Truly, I tell you, they have received their reward in full. But when you give to the needy, do not let your left hand know what your right hand is doing, so that your giving may be secret. Then your Father, who sees what is done in secret, will reward you." And then Jesus goes into prayer, and he says, "And when you pray, do not be like the hypocrites, for they love to pray standing in the synagogues and on the street corner to be seen by others. Truly, I tell you, they have received their reward in full. But when you pray, go into your room, close the door, and pray to your Father who is unseen." Some versions say who is in secret. "Then your Father who sees what is done in secret will reward you. And when you pray, do not keep on babbling like the pagans, for they think they will be heard because of their many words." And then Jesus immediately goes into the Sermon on the Mount. And goes into his next lesson after the Sermon on the Mount. Now we know at this point, Jesus emphasizes some of his most important teachings by repeating them. That's a good teaching technique. He repeats them, though, in different contexts. So we have just heard him say, "If you give to the poor or pray in order to gain respect and popularity, that will be your reward," right? And in the verse before this, I'll go back a minute, when he talks about the left hand and the right hand, metaphysically, the right hand represents spiritual intention, and the left hand represents our human needs. So really, all this series of quotes that he has are about our intention, not our actions, but our intentions. And in both passages, he addresses the secret place, which most of us know metaphysically means that inner sanctuary of our own souls, our own consciousness. And so we continue. He says, by the way, sources for today's lesson are the same as they've been, mainly today from The Secret According to Jesus by Reverend Ed Townley, one of my favorite Bible interpreters, but also the whole series has been based on Emmett Fox's book, The Sermon on the Mount. And so we continue. Now, this is what he says right after the Lord's Prayer, immediately afterwards. He says, "When you fast, do not look somber as the hypocrites do, for they disfigure their faces to show others they are fasting. Truly, I tell you," here comes the repeated lesson, "they have received their" what? Reward, absolutely. "But when you fast, put oil on your head, and wash your face, so it will not be obvious to others that you are fasting, but only to your Father, who is unseen, and who sees what you have done in secret, and he will reward you. Your Father will reward you. So we've already heard Jesus say that prayer and giving to the poor should not be done to make a big show to impress other people. Now he is telling us that that same principle applies to fasting, which, by the way, was a common religious practice in the day. Reverend Ed Townley sees two important teachings, or points, I should say, in these teachings. One is that the activities we claim to do for good, like praying, giving, and fasting, and all the rest, any other things that we think we're doing for good, our reward will be aligned with our intention, our focus. If we do good simply to impress others, there will be no spiritual benefit, even if it's a good act, what we'd call a good act. If, on the other hand, we do good quietly, privately, solely to know God, then that will be our reward. And when we put the divine first, then we are sure that all the other rewards will flow. So it's a win-win, really. Now, this is pretty obvious on a literal level, but there's a second, I would say, more subtle teaching here, and that is where Jesus says, you should not look gloomy, as the hypocrites do. Ed Townley writes, this is Jesus telling his beloved disciples and us that the spiritual path is not meant to be somber, depressing, or sacrificial. Living from the kingdom of heaven within, feeling God's presence and power every moment of our lives, is the greatest of all joys. I ask you, does this guy look very joyful to you? No. It's one of the Pharisees. Jesus, right now he's kind of general about who the hypocrites are. Later he will name them specifically, but this is one of the Pharisees. And the word translated as hypocrite meant actor. Jesus is saying here that people who insist on acting like their closeness to God brings pain and sorrow are hypocrites, actors, pretenders. Reverend Townley says they are pretending to have a level of spiritual awareness that they do not understand and have never experienced. They miss the point, and they are not to be trusted as spiritual examples. Wow. I think Jesus and Reverend Townley alike would probably place these suffering servants very high on the hypocrisy meter. I don't know if it existed in Jesus' day, but if it did, he would have placed them high there. So, the thing is, the important point is that the hypocrites and all their posturing and parading around, looking solemn and dismal, got it wrong. Fasting is not about outer acts at all. Charles Fillmore, our Unity co-founder, tells us that fasting means denial, abstinence from error thoughts, so that we can live in the consciousness of oneness with God. And the pathway to the kingdom of heaven is lined with joy and thanksgiving and knowing ourselves as we truly are. Remember last week we talked about that verse where Jesus says, be perfect as your Father in heaven is perfect. If you were here, remember that? And the word translated as perfect meant what? Who remembers? Whole or complete. And so we are here to be whole. We are here to be complete. We are here to focus on spiritual wholeness, not on our human foibles and failures. And the creative law of the universe says, and we've looked at this before, where our attention or our focus goes, energy flows, and the result shows. It manifests in the outer. We are here to focus on our divine identity, our oneness with spirit and all humankind, and to allow that spiritual perfection that we are to just express in every moment. So, all these teachings today are really related. Next, Jesus says, do not lay up or store up for yourselves treasures on earth where moths and rust and some versions say vermin destroy and where thieves break in and steal. But store up for yourself treasures in heaven, where moths and vermin do not destroy, and where thieves do not break in and steal. For where your treasure is, there your heart will be also." Now, throughout his entire ministry, and especially in the Sermon on the Mount, Jesus' main message is not about things of this world. Ed Townley writes, "Jesus' message is about a new consciousness that transcends the world, a consciousness that is as eternal as this world is temporal." And we know that Jesus calls this new consciousness the kingdom of heaven. But just think for a moment how hard it might have been on that mountaintop for those disciples to grasp that this inner kingdom is immeasurably richer and more beautiful than anything they've ever valued on this earth. It's really revolutionary teaching. Jesus says to them, "Wherever your treasure is, there your heart is also." Now, metaphysically, we know that the heart center is a center of love. That's where our power of love is. Not emotion, not Valentine love and romantic love. We talked about the different kinds of love a few weeks ago. But divine love. It's the center through which we connect to divine love and power. It's where we have conscious communion with perfect divine energy. It's our heart wisdom that allows us to look past appearances from this world to a greater reality. In the heart, greater truths are revealed, and we know our oneness. So from this perfect heart perspective, the key compelling question is, where is your treasure? What do you value? What is it? Career accomplishments? I've been there. Societal recognition? Your degrees, your assets, the number of Facebook friends you can claim? We have all sorts of outer things that we make our reason to be. Townley says, Jesus reminds us, when we place our heart in worldly pleasures, our treasures actually, we may accumulate them, probably we will, but they will not last. Now, this would have been an especially powerful teaching for those disciples because in Jesus' day, just think of it, there were no banks, no building and loan societies, no credit union, no safety deposit boxes. Valuables were usually commodities like silk, woolens, grain, and metals, and they were often hidden in the walls of houses, or stored under the floor, or sometimes even hidden in a secret spot in a nearby field. And none of those passed the test of time. Silks and woolens were destroyed by moths, grain was eaten by insects and animals, and precious metals were often stolen or they succumbed to rust. And today, over 2,000 years later, when we have a bank on every corner and countless ways to invest our earthly treasures, they may last a little longer, but without spiritual understanding, our earthly treasures simply do not fulfill us. Jim Rosemurgy writes, "Like the donkey with the carrot dangling on a stick in front of him, we are compelled. We think we know what brings us peace and joy. But one of two things eventually happens. We continue to want the carrot, but we don't know how to achieve it. We go from person to person, book to book, church to church, without success, without finding what we think we're looking for. Or we do finally grasp the carrot, that perfect job, the ideal soulmate. But the discontent remains. And even if we do find contentment, temporary contentment, as the old saying goes, you can't take it with you, right? In fact, the only things you can take with you when you leave this world are things you've packed inside your heart. Those are eternal. So when we truly value living in the peace, abundance, love, and joy of the divine, then the spiritual lessons we learn, the love we share, the peace we experience will only go stronger and stronger because gifts from spirit, treasures from the heart, are eternal. So we, as usual, have a choice. We can spend our lives chasing earthly distractions, or we can claim the treasure of the kingdom of heaven, a treasure centered in love and manifesting in absolute and endless joy. And here's the good news. Seeking the kingdom of heaven doesn't mean we have to give up the earthly treasures. Later in the Sermon on the Mount, Jesus will say, "Seek first the kingdom of heaven and his righteousness, and all of these things, everything we want and need, will also be added to you as well." This flows beautifully into Jesus' next teaching, which is, "The light of the body is the eye. Therefore, if thine eye be single, thy whole body shall be full of light. But if thine eye be evil," in error, we know the meaning of evil, "thy whole body shall be full of darkness. If therefore the light that is in thee be darkness, how great is thy darkness." Now you can guess right away, we can all guess right away, that Jesus is not talking about the physical eye here, right? Metaphysically, the eye symbolizes spiritual perception. What Jesus calls the eye is the source of light and divine energy within us. Now, it's intriguing. Did you notice I use the King James here, which I don't use very much, all of these and thous? It's intriguing to look at other Bible versions and see the many translations for the word single that King James uses as single. Other translations, and this is certainly not all of them, but just a few of them on a quick internet search, other translations are good, clear, healthy, focused, sound, unclouded, sincere, pure, and perfect, just to name a few translations. Reverend Townley says, this is where the King James Version gets it best. Single, single, steady, focused on one thing, not confused or distorted as a person might see with poor vision. When we rely on the evidence of our senses, our double eyes of human sight draw forth an energy of duality. We see double. We see good and bad. We see evil and good, all of that. We believe sensory evidence that tells us we are separate from God and one another. That's our sensory sight. But when our eye is single, when our eye is single, we rely on the one unified light of the Christ presence within us. We recognize one presence, one power. We see singularly, clearly, because we see only God in expression everywhere. Remember early in the Sermon on the Mount, very early, Jesus told his disciples and us, "You are the light of the world." And when our eye is single, our body is full of light. In laser focus, we move out of duality and fragmentation into oneness, one of our core values, into oneness. So the master of transition, Jesus really is, he goes on and he says, "No one can serve two masters, for either he will hate the one and love the other, or else he will be loyal," some versions say devoted, "to one and despise the other. You cannot serve God and mammon." Now the Greek word translated as mammon meant wealth or treasure. But here Jesus is driving home the points he's made earlier. In the revealing word, Charles Fillmore, our co-founder, explains that metaphysically, mammon represents material or worldly thoughts and beliefs. So it's not having the treasures. We're allowed to have the treasures. It's making them our singular focus. And so what that means is we're comparing that to true inner riches of the mind, spiritual understanding, and the realization of spiritual substance, life, and intelligence. Townley says, this teaching, once again, is simply a new perspective on the oldest of all the laws given to Moses. We looked at this a few weeks ago in the Sermon on the Mount. The first commandment, "I am the Lord your God, you shall have no gods before me." No one can serve two masters, not because it's wrong, but because it is impossible. When we try to serve two masters, it can look something like this. "Sure, God comes first, before and after work, and sometimes on my lunch break. Anybody been there? It's hard. We can't do both. Townley says, to serve two masters means we create a dualistic reality, and that could never be the truth with a capital T. Now, we might be tempted today to think that this teaching about serving two masters has no relevance to us because we're not idol worshipers, are we? Or are we? Right? What second masters do we try to serve? What are our false gods? Our career accomplishments, our financial wealth, success, status, popularity, are those our gods? Whatever it is, Jesus is telling us that it is essential to our own spiritual development to put the divine first. One heart cannot serve two masters. Early in the Hebrew Bible, Joshua recognizes this truth. He tells the tribes that are accumulated around him, choose this day whom you will serve, but as for me and my house, we will serve the Lord. There is no middle path. So really, all the teachings that we've explored today have the same message, in a way, and that is when we shift our thinking from human ego consciousness to spirit consciousness, our entire experience in the outer world shifts along with it. In human ego consciousness, we are concerned with how we appear to others. We cling to the treasures of this world. We rely on the appearance of our human senses, our human eyes, and we try to serve two masters. The problem is that we are living from and sending out mixed messages, and we end up feeling divided and disoriented. Choose this day whom you will serve. We can live from strictly human consciousness, seemingly separated from the divine and one another, or we can live from the heart, from oneness with God and all humankind. The path of living is through and as the presence of God on this earth. It is not always easy, but it leads to the kingdom of heaven and a life of immeasurable abundance, strength, compassion, and joy. And so it is. So let's take a moment today to do as we always do every Sunday, to affirm the great truth about our God, divine mind, all that is. And this is printed in your bulletin for those of you who are here for the first time. Let's do it together today from the heart. Let's feel the spiritual energy behind this word, these words. Let's not make it babbling, okay? Let's make it heartful. So together, there is only one presence and one power in the universe and at work in my life. God, the good, omnipotent, and so it is.